particularly when you're also locked up for a long time, it's very easy for your thoughts to move into the repetitive depressive stream. And so having a tool that can allow you to maintain your mental health while you are incarcerated can significantly improve both your time there and your, you know, self-confidence, your belief in what's possible, your ability to be able to take on new challenges and ideas and grow through this process rather than being stuck in the repetitive nature of it.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones.
So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast.
Ariel is the co-founder of Interaxon, makers of Muse, which is an award-winning brain-sensing headband that I'm sure we'll hear more about during the conversation. Ariel studied neuroscience in Toronto and researched Parkinson's disease and hippocampal neurogenesis. However, alongside this, she's also a fashion designer and has had her work displayed at the Art Gallery of Ontario. Whilst Interaxon is a very successful company, we haven't just invited Ariel on to promote her products, but because she's a really inspirational woman with divergent interests. She's an innovative thinker with lots of creativity, and I'm sure we'll have lots of insights that we'll benefit from today. I'm really not going to be able to do her career justice in this brief introduction, so I think we'll just cut to the chase so that we can hear more about it. Welcome, Ariel.
Thank you, Naomi. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, it's very nice to meet you,
nice to
Ariel.
Meet you as well, David.
Can you tell us a bit about your fascinating career pathway? You've blended some very interesting interests together with fashion and neuroscience, as I understand it.
Yeah, so I've been lucky enough to always have the sense of confidence inside myself that whatever I was interested in, I could probably figure out how to do and, you know, find somebody to mentor me in it and spend time deeply engaging in the subject. So, you know, this sort of open sense of, hey, I can really do whatever I want, allowed me to explore a diverse set of interests and actually be able to go deep in them through really giving myself to the subject. So initially when I was young, the arts were fascinating to me. My mother was an artist, and I was really fascinated by how we created works of art that would express the self. And one of the simplest ways that I would do that was through fashion. You know, fashion is this ever-changing melange of color and texture and shape and form that is an expression of your experience at that moment, your emotions at that moment, or what you wish to project at that moment. There's actually a ton of psychology involved in it. So I became a clothing designer, hired some dressmakers, had them create my designs, and then went out and hit the streets selling my designs on consignment, initially at stores in Toronto, then New York, and then I got a rep, and then I opened my own store, et cetera, et cetera. And before I knew it, I was a fashion designer. At the same time, I was really, I excelled in the sciences because I was fascinated by how the world worked from a technical perspective. And so I started volunteering in science labs and then eventually, you know, getting hired and working in the science labs. And when it came time to go to university, I thought I'd go to school for fashion, but that didn't seem very practical at that point. I went to school for science, which eventually kind of funneled its way into school for neuroscience because I really wanted to understand the psychological aspect of how we work from a very brass tacks perspective. You know, how is it that, you know, the neurons communicating inside our brain are creating the experience of life that we have, the colors that we see, the thought that we have? How is it that a bunch of molecules moving along a concentration gradient are somehow able to generate a human being who has free will and is presumably making, you know, choices and actions and actually impacting their neural concentration gradients as a result of that? And, you know, how does all this play together? So through then diving deeper into the science, being trained in science, then being trained as a psychotherapist as a mechanism to start to apply that scientific understanding and that psychological understanding to people that I was working with, I then began in one of the research labs I was working with to work with this device that was an early brain computer interface device. It was a single EEG electrode that you would put onto your head, and EEG reads your brainwave activity. And we were using it at that time to actually help translate people's brainwaves activity into sound. So as you would relax, you would hear one sound. As you would focus, you would hear a different sound. And I stood back and said, this is incredible. And after many years of working with this technology kind of on the side, like on the side of the other things that I was doing, poking away at it with a bunch of friends and colleagues who also worked in the lab, like we sort of realized, hey, this could be something really valuable for people that could help people's lives. And what we recognized was that as we were teaching people to focus and relax, to control the light bulb or make the sound get brighter, what we were really doing was showing them what was going on inside their brain. We were really showing them, like, hey, you're focused. Hey, you're relaxed. You know, classical biofeedback, in this case, feedback from the brain, so it's called neurofeedback. And eventually that evolved into the creation of a device called Muse that can give you real-time feedback on your brain during meditation. Because, you know, through my work, both as a neuroscientist and a psychotherapist, I would be using meditation as a frontline approach to help people make change in their brain, to help them, you know, learn to decrease their scarcity thinking, their fear, the thoughts that can overwhelm you. But meditation was incredibly hard to do. It was something that I really was terrible at doing. And we recognized through building a tool that could actually show you what was going on in your brain during your meditation, we could actually make the process much easier. And that's how Muse was born. And that sort of ends up being, you know, brings us to today in my career path.
Thank you. That's terribly interesting. Now, I'm somebody who spent most of my life kind of regretting the positions I've held earlier in my life. So, for example, I've never done meditation and I don't really understand meditation. So I wonder if, as a beginning, you could perhaps explain to me what you mean by meditation.
Sure. So there's a number of different definitions of meditation. The secular definition that I use is a practice or a training that leads to healthy and positive mind states. So it's a thing that you do regularly that helps to improve your mind and also your brain. The most basic form of meditation that most people learn first is focused attention meditation. So in a focused attention meditation practice, you are focusing your attention on your breath. When your mind eventually wanders away from your breath and onto a thought, you then notice that you have wandered onto a thought. You then choose to bring your attention away from that thought and back onto your breath. You know, on the one hand, it is incredibly simple, but it can feel quite overwhelming, mainly because a lot of people have a misconception about what meditation is. You know, a lot of people believe that in meditation, your mind is supposed to go blank. So, you know, you sit down, you're like, I'm going to meditate. And you sit there and you wait for your mind to go blank, and it never does. Frankly, it's probably easier to levitate than to make your mind go blank for any period of time. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm terrible at this. Like, what is this thing? This thing is awful. And you get up and you don't do it again. But really in meditation, what we're learning to do is to observe our thinking and to change our relationship to our thoughts. So we're not trying to get rid of our thoughts. We're not trying to say, oh no, you know, my mind is just going to be like this pure blank thing and it's going to be nirvana and bliss. No, no, no. What we're learning to do is say, hey, I'm having a thought. And rather than getting caught up in that thought and thinking about the thought, say, I see that there's a thought here. I'm going to just move my attention elsewhere and not grab onto that thought. I'm going to let that thought go. So you put your attention on your breath, which is something neutral and in the present moment. When a thought grabs your attention, you notice it and you thought, you grab my attention, but you know what? I'm not going to follow you. I'm not going to think about the grocery list or the thing I feel bad about or whatever it is. I'm going to let that thought go and move my attention back to something neutral. A thought will arise again because that's what our brain does. It gives us thoughts. And then we're going to say, nope, don't need you right now. Thank you. Attention back to the breath. And as you do this, it's quite an incredible transformation because instead of being caught in our thinking, wandering mind, like most of us are, most of us just think the thoughts in our head because they're there. And so we presume we're supposed to be thinking them because they're in our head. But when you actually do this practice of saying, hey, I see that there's a thought there and I'm not going to think it. I'm going to choose to do something else. In that instant, you have changed your relationship to your thinking and you now have control over the contents of your own mind. And so you don't have to be as haggard and bothered by the often repetitive, negative, frustrating, you know, misguiding thinking that goes on in your head because you have a mechanism of shifting out of that and changing the course of your thoughts.
Yeah, well, you're dead right. That's precisely the kind of idea I had about meditation, was that you just emptied your mind. But you're describing a much more kind of active process, I think. And, of course, in some ways, it's a reflection or the obverse of psychotherapy, where I'd be asking people to notice what thoughts came into their mind and speak them, which in itself is not such an easy task as we might imagine, I think. Anyway.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a corollary to what you described in that you are noticing your thinking. So, you know, most of us just go through life and have thoughts. And as soon as we engage in either psychotherapy or meditation, we're actually being asked to observe the thoughts and do something different with them than just thinking them. Whereas in psychotherapy, we might be speaking them, rolling around, dissecting them, working through them. In meditation, what we're doing is observing that we're having them and then shifting our attention elsewhere. And that often does allow a far more improved psychotherapeutic process as well, because you're not, you know, you're not ruminating on these thoughts. You're not buried in them. You are gaining objectivity. You're gaining the ability to rise above the thoughts and see them, and often see them for what they are. Because when you're caught up in a thought, it's very easy to believe whatever it's telling you is true, when often it's not. Particularly if you have OCD, anxiety, depression, you know, all of these thoughts are tainted thoughts. They're not thoughts that are actually aligned with reality. And when you're able to rise above the thought, you're able to see, like, hey, actually that thought wasn't necessarily aligned with the reality of this moment, that, you know, I didn't need to do that thing that the thought was telling me to do. I'm not that person the thought is telling me that it is.
Thank you. And I mean, it comes to me that there's obviously some similarities with CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, in this kind of line of thinking, but perhaps we can come back to that. What kind of effects does meditation have upon the brain then?
Meditation can have a host of documented effects on the brain. So there's now over 8,000 studies published about the impact of meditation on the mind and body, your relationships, etc. When we look into the literature specifically around the brain, we see some relatively consistent changes that are reported. So one thing that we tend to see in the literature around meditation's impact on the brain is a decrease in the activity of the amygdala. So the amygdala is that part of your brain that's associated with the fight or flight response. It is the part of your brain that's always scanning for danger and serving you information about things that are potentially threatening to you, whether they are actually threatening or just an imaginary threat, or just, you know, looks like something that was previously possibly a threat. So our amygdalas are always firing, and many of us have hyperactive amygdalas, which creates a greater sense of fear, anxiety, stress, etc. And so in a meditation practice, what you see is often, if you're looking in an MRI machine with somebody with a long-term practice, you can see a decrease in the activation of the amygdala. And you can even see in long-term meditators a decrease in the size of the amygdala. So, you know, this organ is really being used less. It is reducing in its impact in your brain. And one of the reasons that we might be seeing that is in the literature, you also see an increase in the size of the prefrontal cortex. So the prefrontal cortex is the part of your brain in the front. It is the higher order processing of your brain. It's a thing responsible for planning, organization, attention, which is strengthened in a meditation practice, and inhibition, which is often, you know, a really big deal for people who are not great at inhibiting their thoughts and their actions. You know, you have a thought and you just jump to it and you do it. Well, meditation practice teaches you to strengthen your inhibition, because it also strengthens your prefrontal cortex. And it's also the seat of your logical, wise decision making. So it's kind of like the prefrontal cortex is the parent and the amygdala is the child. And the amygdala, you know, is easily scared by things. It sees a shadow on the wall and it starts freaking out. But the prefrontal cortex is the parent who's able to look around, say, hey, it's just a shadow, you know, calm down, little amygdala, it's fine, it's all good. And so what we see in a long-term meditation practice is a maintenance of the thickness of the prefrontal cortex, or a strengthening of the area of the prefrontal cortex. And you can also even see an increase in the projections between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, meaning that you have an improved communication between that, you know, wise inhibitory part of your brain and the little child that's always freaking out. So through a long-term practice, your amygdala is able, your prefrontal cortex is able to look around and say, hey, everything's okay. You know, it's just a thought. It's not real. It's not something we have to worry about. Shh, calm down. Shh, calm down. And so you're able to gain better emotional self-regulation. You feel less stressed. You feel less fear. And you're able to more effectively move on and make better choices in your life.
That's a brilliant answer. Thank you very much. Do you think there's a kind of person who's likely to find meditation most useful, or is it useful for anybody?
So much like psychotherapy, everybody can benefit from. So, you know, in meditation, it's something that is generally good for everybody who does it. It can be frustrating to start the practice, but once you get it, you know, the benefits are really significant. So I have not met a person who, once they've gotten a meditation practice, hasn't found benefit from it. And the benefits that you tend to see initially are just improved sense of calm. You're just able to be like, oh, I just feel a little bit calmer. You might be better able to observe your thoughts. You might feel like you have less thoughts in your head, that it's just sort of emptier and quieter in there. And there's a neuroscientific corollary for that. So there's a part of your brain called the default mode network. If you stick somebody in an MRI machine and you say, just relax, like don't think about anything, just be, what you're gonna see is activity in this loop between the prefrontal cortex and the PCC, posterior cingulate cortex. And that's called your default mode. And that represents the internal dialogue that's just always kind of chattering away in our brain. And actually, when you stick a long-term meditator in an fMRI machine and you say, just relax, just don't think about anything, you don't see activity in that area of the brain. And you have the self-report of a quiet brain. So when we talk about, you know, the monkey mind or the mental chatter that you might hear in meditation speak, there's actually a real correlate in the brain that you see an increase in, that you see a decrease in, a change in. And that is this loop of internal dialogue. So, you know, people who have a lot of repetitive ruminating thoughts, meditation is fantastic because it teaches you how to get out of them, how to A, identify that they're not real, they're not you, you don't need them, and B, how to move your mind away from it and quiet that internal dialogue.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to invite you on, Ariel, was because of both David and I have worked in forensic systems for a long time, and increasingly in recent years has been a move towards trying to teach the people who are detained in secure institutions, psychiatric hospitals and prisons, the skills of meditation and mindfulness. But certainly also you can see that there's a place for that with the staff, because people in environments where people feel a lot of fear, there's a lot of danger, people can rush to make quite impulsive decisions. And I think having a practice of mindfulness does encourage people to take a pause and be able to make decisions in a much more rational and considered way.
Absolutely. And so, you know, there are a number of studies that demonstrate the benefits of meditation for inmates. You know, when you're often, you've become an inmate because you have impulsivity, because you haven't sufficiently developed your ability to inhibit your actions. Sometimes it's because you have an underlying mental health issue. Sometimes it's because you're driven by fear and scarcity thinking, and so you're not able to have rational control over your actions. And so in each of these cases, a practice that allows you to improve your inhibition, down-regulate your emotional reactions, your negative emotional reactions, and have a more objective view of yourself and the world and what's going on, you know, all of that is incredibly beneficial. And particularly when you're also locked up for a long time, it's very easy for your thoughts to move into the repetitive depressive stream. And so having a tool that can allow you to maintain your mental health while you are incarcerated, to be able to move out of those very, very difficult, very sticky negative thoughts. And, you know, if not move out of them fully, at least be able to temper them and put them at bay somewhat, can significantly improve both your time there and your, you know, self-confidence, your belief in what's possible, your ability to be able to take on new challenges and ideas and grow through this process rather than being stuck in the repetitive nature of it. And likewise with the staff as well, you know, all of the same skills apply. You know, the staff is no different in their need to be able to emotionally self-regulate, in their ability, in their need to move out of negative thinking, in their need to move out of bias. You know, one of the biggest things that can be problematic with a staff member in an institution is the biases that you may have around your inmates. And meditation practices also allow you to see reality more clearly, to identify and understand your own biases, and to see where fears trigger your patterned reactions towards negative biases where they don't necessarily need to. So it's a very valuable tool.
Thank you. Another great answer. So I was thinking, how did you get into meditation yourself? Was it through the science that you were doing, or were there other reasons? And what kind of thing would you advise somebody like me, who's been, I suppose, a bit of a skeptic, to help them get into meditation?
Sure. So I, you know, being fascinated by the brain, was always fascinated by meditation. Being in neuroscience, knew the research, and being a psychotherapist, was trying to teach my patients meditation. And throughout all of this, I sucked at meditating. Throughout all of this, I tried to establish a practice. I was one of those people who sat down, my brain bounced all over the place. I said, oh my God, I suck at this, therefore I feel bad about it, therefore I don't want to do it, and I would just get up and walk away. And the whole thing, you know, existed in a very negative loop for me. And it was only through the process of building Muse and having a tool that could actually give me feedback and say, yes, this is what you're supposed to be doing, you know, be patient, hang out with it, that I was able to actually build a meditation practice. And then from there, you know, the whole world of meditation opened up to me. I'm like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Okay, now I get it. You know, now I can sit for an extended period of time and not get frustrated by it. Now I get it. In terms of advice for building a practice, one, start out with very small amounts. So you don't have to sit there for 10 minutes, you know, start meditating for 1 minute. And the simplest thing you can do is just watch your breath. It's really, really simple. You just watch your breath going in and out and in and out. You might have a thought about something. Totally okay. It's okay to have thoughts. We're humans. Our brain generates all sorts of stuff. Some of it good, some of it bad. It doesn't matter. It's just what our brain did. So you had a thought, and instead of following the thought, just let it go. You know, you can see it passing by like a cloud, and come on back to your breath. And start doing that for just 1 minute a day. You can then extend it to 3 minutes a day. Once you're comfortable at 3 minutes, extend it to 5 minutes. And just as you do this practice of just sitting with your breathing, you know, the act of breathing, your breaths will naturally start to elongate and slow, which is going to calm your body. It's going to trigger something called your vagus nerve, which is a good thing. You want that triggered, because it brings your body into rest and digest. And so you calm your body, calms your mind a little bit, and more you do it, the more it builds. And you know, it doesn't have to be something special or fancy. You don't need a special spot in your house. You don't need a special time of day. You know, the most common question I get asked is, when's the best time to meditate? And the truth is, the best time is just whenever you're gonna do it. It doesn't matter if it's morning, night, whenever, just sit down for 3 minutes a day and do it. You don't need to sit in a special location. You don't need to sit in a special posture. Just sit in a comfy chair, sit on your couch, lie in your bed, you know, whatever works for you. And that bit by bit is going to allow you to build and then maintain a habit.
Thank you.
Is there anyone who shouldn't meditate where it might be contraindicated?
That's a great question. So in cases of trauma, you have to sometimes tread more carefully with meditation, because the act of sitting in silence may bring up difficult emotions that you may not be ready to deal with. So in that case, you want to meditate with the help of a tool or a professional initially, so that you have some help and support through those difficult moments. In general, meditation is extremely helpful for trauma, because it helps you sit through the physiological and psychological experiences of it. So in trauma, you may have a sensation in your body that's very intense and very fearful, that is triggered by your past experience, But that thing is not here and now. And so I had trauma in my life, and it was really through meditation that I learned that that feeling in my body, like there's somebody kind of grabbing me, it's actually not happening. That like I'm sitting here completely safe in my little room, and I might have this feeling in my body, and instead of in the past as I would have, which is like freak out, I'm like, oh my God, this is awful, you know, like, and then everything becomes tainted with like fear and awfulness. It's like, oh, I'm having a sensation that has nothing to do with this moment right now. So it really helped me dismantle the fact that, oh, it's just a sensation. It's just my body doing a super weirdo reaction that makes sense because it's remembering something from the past. It's not here. It's not now. I'm totally safe. And I can actually just sit through my body having this reaction and get to the other side of it. And actually everything's fine. So, you know, it can be extremely helpful with trauma, but there are cases where you may want extra support if that's something that you're finding triggering for you.
That's interesting and helpful. It makes me think of the Safe and Sound Protocol, which is a musical protocol which is designed to calm anxiety, but again has to be done in the presence of another so that you get the benefit of being with a safe, supportive other. And it sounds like for people who find meditation quite triggering itself, doing that with somebody that's trusted could be a useful way to start to build that practice.
Yeah, one of the things that we also find with Muse is, you know, some people find it very scary, the thought of being alone with your thoughts. You know, you're safe, it's totally fine, everything's fine, but just the idea of being alone with your thoughts is scary. And so what Muse does is it gives you guiding sounds. So as your mind wanders off into a thought, you hear the sound of the storm pickup. And as you come to quiet, focused attention, you hear like very nice nature sounds and the chirping of birds. So we often find that with people who have a heightened, you know, fear reaction to being alone in their thoughts, or, you know, I don't want to listen to my thoughts, Muse makes it much easier because there's a guide that's making some noise in your head so you don't have that fear of being alone in your thoughts, and you're not even hearing the contents of your thoughts. You're not hearing the contents of your mind. You're just being cued thinking, not thinking, thinking, not thinking, and it becomes a much more pleasant experience for somebody who may be anxious about that.
Thank you. That's helpful to have that clarified. And what's the relationship between meditation and sleep, and why is sleep so important for our brains anyway?
Oh my God, sleep is so important for our brains. So sleep not only has cognitive benefit for our brain, and certainly, you know, most of us know when we don't sleep well, we feel kind of foggy, we feel like our reactions are delayed, but it also has emotional and psychological benefit for the brain. So those who sleep less than 6 hours on a cognitive task tend to perform as if they're about 9 years older than they actually are. So, you know, if you want to be on the ball and alert and, you know, youthful in your mind, sleep is key. Lack of sleep also impacts our ability to emotionally self-regulate. So we know that little kids, when they don't have their naps, get super cranky and, you know, irritable. Well, us adults, actually the same thing is happening. It's just subtler and we're better at hiding it. So when you sleep well, you're better able to maintain your emotional self-regulation, you're better able to maintain your cognitive function, and even the clearing of your brain seems to be happening when you sleep. So while you sleep, there's these little pathways in your brain called our glymph system, and they let fluids move through your brain at night and flush out any metabolites, any products in your brain that you don't need, potentially even including beta amyloid, which is one of the precursors for Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, really our brains get a great power wash while you sleep at night, allowing your brain to be ready and active the next day, as well as being able to maintain its function in the long term. So sleep, super good for your brain. Go ahead.
That was really interesting in terms of that that metaphor about giving your brain a bit of a power wash, because I read also that kind of like breathing through your nose and the kind of like the slow breathing out through your nose has that same effect as well of helping the blood wash over the brain, which presumably is having a similar impact.
Yeah. Anytime you're moving things more effectively through your brain, it's good. So increase in blood flow means that you're increasing the oxygen to your brain, because often our brains don't work that well because they're not as highly oxygenated as they should be. And that's why things like exercise can significantly improve your cognitive function, actually for many reasons. Exercise also upregulates a mechanism called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which can help your brain grow when new neurons grow. And this process that I was talking about is moving a different kind of fluid through your brain that helps wash it out. So yeah, moving things through the brain is actually a good thing. You also asked about the relationship between meditation and sleep. So there's lots there. So meditation and sleep are not the same. Your brain is not doing the same thing when you meditate as it is when you sleep, but both of them have very beneficial attributes for your brain. They're both quite beneficial for your brain. And meditation can significantly help to improve sleep. So as you do your meditation practice, as we've talked about extensively, you're learning to shut your ruminating mind. And one of the primary reasons that people can't fall asleep at night is because, what do you say? Well, my mind's just racing. My thoughts are just going. And so when you teach your brain that actually you can let go of those thoughts, we can quiet down now, it becomes much, much easier to fall asleep. And we also see a big relationship between stress and anxiety and poor sleep. So, you know, a lot of people that can't sleep can't do so because they are stressed and anxious. And so again, when you engage your meditation practice, you're learning to decrease the stress, both from a psychological level, both from the stressful thoughts, and a physiological level. So when you downregulate the scary thoughts, and when you breathe deeply, you know, more deeply into your belly, into your chest, more slowly, you're activating the rest and digest system in your body, which is reducing your cortisol levels, which means your cortisol levels are quieter as you're going into sleep, which means it's easier for your body to sleep. And there's another relationship between anxiety and sleep, which is interesting, which is one of the primary reasons people can't sleep or get poor sleep, particularly when you wake up in the middle of the night, is because you're worried about not sleeping. It's like the most ironic thing in the world. You wake up and you're like, oh my God, I can't sleep. Oh no, what's gonna happen? And then you've engaged all of your, you know, cognitive processes around it, you've ramped your anxiety around it, you've ramped the cortisol in your body, and all of a sudden you're really not sleeping because you're worried about not sleeping. And of course, what a meditation practice allows us to do is quiet those thoughts, accept what's happening in the moment, you know, it's okay that I'm not sleeping now. And often if you'll just move your mind into meditation in those moments, you'll calm your mind and body, and before you know it, you'll be asleep. And even if you don't sleep, so you've meditated for 2 hours instead of rolling around anxious, you know, both had their benefit.
That's a very positive spin on that. Can you tell us something about Muse for those who aren't familiar with it?
Sure. So Muse is a brain sensing headband that helps you meditate and sleep. It is a clinical grade EEG, so it has little sensors on your forehead and behind the ears. And just like a Fitbit on your wrist can track your heartbeat and your movements, what Muse is tracking is your level of focus and relaxation. We can't actually read what's going on in your brain in any detail, in any way. We're just looking at the signals that relate to levels of focus and levels of relaxation. And what it lets you do is really understand when you're doing it right in a meditation practice. The metaphor we use is your mind is like the weather. So in that meditation practice, when your mind wanders off onto a thought, you hear it as stormy. And that's your cue to know, hey, you're in a thought, come on back. And then as you come on back to quiet focused attention on your breath, it quiets that storm and you hear pleasant little sounds. And then as soon as your mind wanders off again, the storm picks up. That's your cue to be like, hey, come on back. And you bring your attention back to your breath. And so it becomes this very simple, straightforward way to build or deepen your meditation practice. And then after the fact, you get data, charts, graphs, scores, things that actually show you moment by moment what your brain is doing. So, you know, somewhat like a video game, there's a gamification to it that makes it sticky, that makes you want to come back to it, that, you know, you gain little birds and chart and badges. And so it actually becomes a very effective way to start your practice. And then we also have another tool that tracks your sleep and can help you fall asleep and stay asleep.
Could you tell us a bit more about the sleep aid element to that?
Sure. So Muse is able to track sleep almost as effectively as a sleep lab. So when you go into a sleep lab, you have all these wires on your head and it's awful. Well, Muse is this slim, comfortable, super easy to get cozy and little device. And it's able to track your stages of sleep as you're falling asleep. And what it does is we have something called the digital sleeping pill. So rather than taking a actual sleeping pill, which, you know, interrupts your brain and body in all sorts of negative ways, the digital sleeping pill is an audio experience that you're listening to that's actually able to cue your brain for sleep. And so as you are falling asleep, the audio gets gentler, it fades, it slows down, it morphs and changes in a way that guides your brain into sleep. And then if you wake up in the middle of the night, the Muse wakes up with you. It gives you a couple minutes to see if you fall asleep on your own. And if not, it then brings in the same beautiful audio experience, which might be a sleep story, a guided meditation, a visualization, to help you fall back asleep again. And again, as soon as it quiets to cue your brain into sleep, and as soon as you're asleep, it shuts right off and gets out of the way. So it's really this amazing intervention that we just had a study done by Dr. Adrian Owen. He's a famous British neuroscientist, the University of Western Ontario, now in Canada. And he demonstrated that using the Muse to help you sleep, both with the meditation and the sleep intervention, improves sleep quality by over 20%.
Well, that sounds really fascinating, especially as I think so many people become a bit obsessive about their sleep, a bit preoccupied, and then I think try sleeping tablets out of desperation, which of course then disrupts the sleep pattern anyway, doesn't it? So fascinating that you've managed to develop something that can help the brain more naturally, I think.
I don't take sleeping tablets, but I do often listen to the BBC World Service at night, and that's probably the last thing I should be doing, because it's usually filled with stories of tragedy and conflict.
Yes, it is ramping your brain into fear and anxiety, and probably filling your dreams with very fascinating imagery that you may or may not want in there. Yep, so I recommend, you know, a gentle guided meditation, nice visualization of flying through the air, something that's going to bring you to a place of better calm and self-regulation.
Yeah, that sounds like good advice. And don't you have some experience of this kind of thing, Naomi?
I've tried Muse, but not the digital sleeping form of that. But I've used things like bioneurofeedback devices and the Apollo Neuro as well. So I really like technology, and I think it's good to explore and find things that work for you. And so, Ariel, you also co-host a podcast, Untangle, with Patricia Karpas, which I've listened to and really liked, actually. Can you tell us a bit about the theme of your podcast, how it came about, and the kind of content you cover, as I think that it's likely to appeal to some of our listeners?
Sure. So the Untangle podcast is a podcast where we bring on guests that talk specifically about the brain, meditation, neuroscience, and how to make improvements in your life. So it's very actionable. You're learning about how your brain works, or you're learning about some facet of your life, be it anxiety, depression, sleep, and then there are always takeaways of how you can use that knowledge and information to help improve your life in a very tangible and actionable way. So it's such a joy and a pleasure to, you know, engage with all of our guests, from top meditation experts to super cool neuroscientists to artists and musicians. I do a lot around music and how to use music to help support your mood in your day, and I have people actually play live on it. So we're always exploring new techniques to help and support people's better living.
Thank you. Yes, I would encourage people to check that out. So thanks, Ariel. That's been a brilliant conversation, really full of lots of very interesting bits of information, but things I think people will find practically useful to support them in their work.
Thank you so much. It's been a genuine pleasure to be here.
It's been really lovely meeting with you and hearing about all these particular experiences and skills that you've been telling us about. So thanks a lot for that.
Thank you. My joy and pleasure.